Good afternoon. Thank you all so much for joining us. I am April Franco, and I'm a professor of economics and strategic management here at the Department of Management. And I also have the honor of being the chair of the Department of Management. And I get to welcome you. So welcome. Thank you all so much for joining us at this very special occasion, where we are fortunate to learn from one of Canada's preeminent industry leaders, Frank Stronach. But before we get started, I would like to take a moment to acknowledge the land on which the University of Toronto operates. As my way of supporting the goals of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I have learned whose land I'm on and some of the history of this land. Of course, the answer is never an easy one, because who tells your story or your history or who signed the treaties often determines what we know about this land. Of course, some of the learnings are not comfortable ones. Underlying the recognition of whose land this was when settlers arrived is a story of dispossession, destruction, appropriation, and the genocide of those from the communities, which continues today with missing and murdered women and children. As we move forward, we must remember that learning and understanding this painful history is an important first step in reconciliation. Of course, the University of Toronto and UTSC, the University of Toronto Scarborough, has been very active in trying to address some of this. So many of you might know that now the University of Toronto offers tuition waivers for members of six Indigenous communities, as well as the Department of Management offers scholarship to Black and Indigenous scholars who attend our classes. And it was started and founded by the staff and faculty. Thank you. Since time immemorial, Indigenous peoples living in societies and nations were on this land. This is the traditional lands of the Huron-Wendat and the Seneca. We also know of this land as part, the history of this land as part of the oral history of the Ashkenazic and the Haudenosaunee nations. Together, these nations had an agreement known as the dish with one spoon that describes both the history of this land and also how the land could be shared to the mutual benefit of all its inhabitants. Further, the Mississaugas of the Credit were the signatories to the Treaty 13 on which Toronto sits, and the Eastern Mississauga communities, including the Curve Lake First Nation, were the signatories to the Williams Treaties on which Scarborough sits today. Today, Toronto is home to a large, active, diverse, urban Indigenous community from many nations. I acknowledge all of these people and am grateful to have the opportunity to live, work, and learn on this land. And now let me talk a little bit about Frank Stronach. He is the founder and honorary chairman of the board of Magna International, which is the world's one of the world's largest diversified automotive parts supplier. I think you're going to correct me on some of these, but we'll get there. Just to tell you a little bit about Mr. Stronach's history, he arrived in Canada as an immigrant. Canada is lucky that for whatever reason we gave him a visa before the other places he applied for visas. So he came here and started working. In fact, he started Magna International in a garage and then built it into the powerhouse with more than 170,000 employees in more than 30 countries around the world, and has sales of over $40 billion. That's with a B, He is currently the founder and chairman of Stronach International, a company whose mission is to enhance society and the environment through micromobility transportation and organic agribusiness, which are two of the fastest growing economic trends globally. Mr. Stronach, in his time as the chairman and as the founder of those firms, developed and now champions a unique management philosophy known as the Fair Enterprise, which advances employee equity and prosperity for all of the members who work and invest in those companies. This is one of the reasons why, when you see the film, you will see that many people, including labor leaders and politicians, hold him in such high regard. He was just appointed as our newest executive in residence. Our executive in residence program is just one example of the University of Toronto Scarborough's management's commitment to connecting our students with industry leaders, as well as to involve their expertise directly in our curriculum. It's one of the many reasons why the majority of our co-op BBA students have full-time job offers before they graduate. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. We are thrilled to access Mr. Stronach's depth of experience and expertise as students, faculty, and staff. And so with that, let's learn more about his life and impact. Please play the video.
In 1954, at the age of 21, Frank Stronach arrived in Canada with one small suitcase and not much else. Today, he's changed the way cars are made, and along the way, reinvented the sport of horse racing.
I'm a great believer in luck. The harder I work, the more luck I have.
Sure, he had no more than a few hundred dollars in his pocket, but he had skill, savvy, and a vision.
In my early years, I had no great philosophies. My only drive was never to be hungry anymore.
In 1957, Frank opened his first small factory in Toronto. Times were tough, and he didn't get his first car contract until 1960, an order for 300,000 sun visor brackets. He never looked back.
Do I respect him as a businessman? Absolutely. I respect anybody that starts out sleeping on a bench in a garage.
This is not an easy business, and to build upon success, this is not something you see every day.
He has a good understanding of people and what motivates people. He, you know, says, look, using common sense, what would motivate me?
You know the Magna culture, right? Nobody works for me. You people work with me. I'm working for you.
The roots of the Magna culture began when Frank introduced a profit-sharing plan in his factories. He calls it Fair Enterprise. Wall Street calls it Frank Stronach's success formula.
The history of mankind has always been dominated by the golden rule. Here's the gold makes the rule. But I don't want to be dominated by anyone. If I feel that strong, I should not be able to dominate somebody either.
And that's why Frank created a corporate constitution and an employee's charter that are unique in the world of business. In 1960, Frank bought his first horse. And today, he's one of the world's leading thoroughbred owners.
Frank, you and Magna have created so many jobs for people around the world, and in the process have enriched so very many communities. I'm proud to know you. I'm proud of our friendship. I'm proud of the vision you display throughout your business career.
In 1995, Frank was inducted into the Canadian Business Hall of Fame. In 1998, his horse Awesome Again won the Super Bowl of horse racing, the Breeders' Cup. In 1999, he was awarded the Order of Canada. In 2004, he donated $8 million to the local hospital for Aurora and Newmarket, Ontario, and once again won the Breeders' Cup with Ghost Zapper.
Ghost! Stafford.
Today, that young tool and die maker who came to Canada 50 years ago is a respected entrepreneur, a community leader, and the premier player in the sport of Kings. And along the way, he's done it all his way.
Over $500 million has been raised to help the victims of Hurricane Katrina. Many Canadians have opened up their wallets, including Canadian auto giant mogul Frank Stronach, the founder of Magna. Yesterday, he headed down to Florida to meet with the hundreds of people he's helping by providing them with accommodations at his horse training facility, Palm Meadows.
I can't think of a better guy or a bigger mensch than my friend Frank Stronach. You and Magna have done so much for communities and charities around the world. Congratulations once again.
I sometimes say, you know, I'm not quite sure yet when I grow up what I will do, you know. There's a lot of pride when you start something from scratch. So you want to look down the road and say, I hope you've put the right foundations in that this company will carry on for the next 200 years.
Mr. Stronach has also agreed to welcome questions from the audience after his lecture, so please be sure to participate in the lively question and answer period as well as dialogue following his talk. And now, please welcome, join me in welcoming Frank Stronach.
Thank you. I guess all microphones work here. Okay, great. Okay, it's great to be here. I always like to interface with young people. Is their mind still open? I just hope that by the time you leave, that you say, gee, I've wasted a nice Saturday afternoon. I hope my remarks will provoke your minds and be beneficial to your minds. Life is really a question of fate and circumstances. To be at the right place at the right time with the right ingredients. And I have, it seems, I've always been at the right place at the right time. And I've always said, it doesn't matter how smart you are, if the stars are not aligned, it won't work, right? And sometimes I'm a little tough on the Canadian bureaucracy, but when I was a young man, call it a boy, I wanted to see the world. I had to go someplace where I was to get a work visa, and I applied for South Africa, Australia, the United States, and Canada for a visa, and Canada came through first with a visa. So circumstances, I wound up in Canada. So I want to do my part. It's a great country. And the primary reason I'm here is I think we have a chance to I think the world needs an economic charter of rights. Especially in the Western countries, we have great human charters of rights, but they're not sufficient, okay? I really believe it's so important to have economic charters of rights. The company I kind of started, Magna International, it's more than a company, it's really a culture. We call it the Fair Enterprise System. And the basic philosophy on Fair Enterprise is the human charter of rights alone is not sufficient. It has to be fortified with an economic charter of rights. Economic charters of rights will lead to economic democracies, and economic democracies are the basis for democracy itself. So anyway, I think the Fair Enterprise is a forerunner for an economic charter of rights, and I hope I'd be able to talk to you and answer questions where we could go about it. How could an economic charter of rights be developed by the University of Toronto, the Scarborough Division, huh? And with the students, with the faculty member, because a charter of rights, you need a lot of input so we don't miss anything, right? So that's very important. But let me the way the world's still functioning at this time, my remarks in the video, I did say the world has always been dominated by the golden rule. It still is dominated. Who has the gold makes the rule. I don't want to be dominated by anyone. If I feel that strong, I should not be able to dominate somebody either. So really what it boils down to, how can we dismantle the chains of domination? Not via violent revolution, only via revolution of the mind. And that's why we're here for, and that's why I like to interface. There are ways, huh? Because most people are good people, but we all go to an evolutionary process, right? And I hope this process here where we be able to formulate and down the road an economic charter of rights will be adopted, right? The reason why I'm saying it's so crucial that we have economic charters of rights. The discrepancy, the divide between the very rich and the working class gets bigger and bigger every day. And that won't work. That won't function. And when you take a look at the United States, the statistics show that about 2% of the people hold about 60% of the assets. It's not feasible, right? Okay, so I've always said, when it comes down to matters, it's the economy. If the economy doesn't work, nothing else will work. You cannot feed the hungry. You cannot look after the most fragile people, the elderly, the sick, and the handicapped. Every politician agrees, every business people agree, if the economy doesn't work, nothing else will work. You know, the funny part about the whole thing is, we do not talk what drives the economy. The economy is driven by three forces: smart managers, hardworking employees, and investors. All three have a right to the outcome, which is profits. The message I want to get across: employees have a moral right to some of the profits to help to generate. Without employees, you cannot generate profits. So I think if people understand, I think they would agree on that, huh? And the funny part is, Magna is, call it the perfect role model. When I put in a corporate constitution in the late 80s, a corporate constitution and the labor charter of rights, the corporate constitution, its foremost principle was, what do we do with the profits? So we laid down in a charter form what we do with the profits. So 20% of the profits go to the investors, 10% of the profits go to the workers, half in cash, half in shares, over and above their wages. Management gets 6% of the profits. Research, we put 7%, because without research, there's no future, right? So it's very important companies do research. And 2% went to charity. The first year when they put in this charter, our profits went up 40%. The second year, the profits went up 100%. The third year, they went up 200%. So if business, I blame business being short-sighted. Okay, because if you would share with employees, you will make more monies. The problem now is workers know instinctively, they know, their gut feeling is the playing field is not level. It's slanted to the very rich. Okay, and thereby workers only do what they have to do, not to get fired. But there's no spirit, there's no... Huh? So it's absolutely, it's so important, huh? When I put the profit sharing program in for the workers, I unleashed an energy of incredible forces, okay? We could have a society where we could eliminate poverty, we could have, we do great, great things, huh? And that brings me also to a point, you know, when we are younger, most of us, including myself, we all hustle to make some monies so we can live in dignity, et cetera, et cetera. And just as the video showed, from a garage up, I created a company with 170,000 employees. It's incredible. I don't know that that ever has been done before to that size. I'm in 34 different countries. I could live in dignity in any one of those countries, you know, 34 different countries. I choose Canada, huh? I actually, matter of fact, I could see Canada maybe as the last country where we could develop an economic charter of rights and be a role model for the world, right? It's not only, you know, do we compete as countries in the Olympics, et cetera, et cetera. Hopefully we will be civilized enough that we will compete with other countries where we, Canada, would have the highest living standards and where countries will copy and say, gee, we want to adopt the same principles than XX, than Canada, right? Because, you know, the dangers of war is, you know, it looms over a bit. So I think we have to create a moral model and we have to preach over and over. There's a better way. There's a better way of running the world or create the right environment of the world where we could eliminate poverty. And I think we have a role model. We could sit down. Universities are an ideal place where we could explore economic charters of rights. Because you got auditoriums, you could invite people which have been very successful or have achieved great things. Yes, we universities have been involved in creating great medicine, great technologies, many great things. But you know, over the years, I've given a lot of lectures from Harvard right across the United States, from Canada, from Toronto, right across Canada, and also in Europe. It only the last few years, right? And I always say, Frank, I always thought I'm a reasonable, smart guy. I'd say, gee, I've been missing a lot. The thing what I was missing is where I saw a void in universities. The mandate of a university is to teach young people how can we create a more civilized country. What we have been neglecting, and I'm also to blame for it, is we got to develop a structure. What would constitute an ideal society? We got to have a structure which would lead to an ideal society. And I guess if we interface, I'd be available anytime to interface with faculty, with students, because, you know, I've reached a certain age. Sometimes I go for a walk in a forest. I sit down on a stone or on a tree stump and I count my blessings and I ask myself, gee, life has been incredible, great to me. I've seen the highest of the high. I've also experienced the lowest of the low. And there was time early in my life when I was hungry, not because I wanted to lose weight. I was hungry. I didn't have money to buy the food. That leaves a deep impression on your soil, right? And sometimes I do worry. I know one of the great worries is that maybe 60% in most countries, the workers live from paycheck to paycheck. You know the stress for mothers when they think, how can I come up with some food next week or the week after?
So there's no need for that, right? In a civilized society with the right structure, we could eliminate all that thing and create less stress. Of course, we also got to realize, I've always said, yes, we got to bring the great divide down. You know, right now, there's the steep mountains and deep valleys. But so we gotta bring that down. The divide is too great. But at the same time, I do say, a society which stifles its citizens in pursuit of productivity, creativity, and ingenuity is a decaying society. So we gotta be very careful, right? The capitalistic system is great to create wealth, but the wealth has to be shared, okay? And again, I've been working on a basic program which is absolutely non-political. I'm basically saying if the economy, if some of the principles are not maintained, it's impossible that the economy could work. So I'm trying to convince politicians of every stripe, For the love of the country, let's come up with some economic principles. And part of that, a very important part of that is, I have a seven-point principle. The one principle is, first of all, you can never correct anything if you point finger, it's the fault of XXX. It doesn't solve things. And it never solves, too, if you come in with a chainsaw. But we can't do in a civilized way. I think our debt is enormous. Our interest payments every month are over 150 million. Our debt's climbing. What do we leave our kids behind? That should be. So basically, I recommend in 20 years, we should have Canada should have no more debt. We could wipe out that debt, right? And there's programs we can do it. Secondly, the bureaucracy is enormous. I'm not blaming the bureaucrats because in a civilized country, every person's got a right to find a job, whatever the openings are. But I'm saying look, you got sons and daughters, you got kids. If you keep on going together we can build a society, we can build a structure which is civilized, because you cannot have so much bureaucracy. It's not feasible. I could never build a Magna anymore, right? It would be impossible because I built maybe three factories a month in the average, right? So I could never do it anymore. But again, together, we could find solutions in a very civilized way, right? And the third principle would be our tax system is no country can survive, no country can do well if people don't understand the tax system. The tax system is not understand. When I run Magna, I had on one hand, I had about 20 lawyers. On the other hand, I had about 20 high-profile financial people. The first, if I wanted to do something, I checked with the lawyer, is this legal if we're going to do XXX? They say, yes, it's legal. Then I went to the financial thing. How would that be treated? After a week or so, they say, there's not an answer. But there's specialists in the city which could maybe find solutions. But you got a big bill, and after one or two, you got a big bill after 1 or 2 weeks, and they said, look, it's great. We don't. So we need a tax system people understand and which fair. If you make more monies, you pay more, and if you make less monies or below 100,000, you shouldn't pay any tax, right? There is, so the system is slanted towards the rich, right? So again, that's why it's so important we have. The fourth point would be that I divide companies in small companies below 300 people that would be small would be classified as small companies. Above 300 people would be classified as large companies. Large companies, the law would say, the company's gotta pay out a portion of the dividends to the workers. This way you can balance out a bit or bring it on a more civilized level, where, call it, you bring the gold holdings or the money holdings down. And so that would be. And the fifth principle is small companies are the backbone of any country. In small companies, new products gonna be developed, okay? And small companies pay the most taxes because there's so many of them, even sometimes there's five employees, but together there's a lot of employees, and it's the wage taxes which are collected, which is a great bearing in the tax system. So small companies, you want to eliminate totally the red tape, totally, okay? And there's two rules small companies have to maintain. Workplace safety, you don't want to see anybody losing a hand or fingers, and nobody can dump poisonous chemicals in the backyard. Those are the only two rules. Everything else, it's, you know, this way, the bureaucracy, yes, you need some, but it should be a percentage of the gross national product, right? We could do that and so to balance things out. But again, it's an evolutionary process. We're not pointing fingers whose fault it is, but together we can do it. The fifth point is, which is a great has a great bearing on my mind, no Canadian kid should go to school hungry. That means breakfast has to be served. No Canadian kid should leave the school hungry. That means lunch has got to be served. And the law would state that school food has to be organic. Okay, that is my, I'll be striving to see that will happen one of these. The fourth thing, the seventh principle is high school should stop at grade 10. In grade 11 and grade 12 is where we would teach kids trades. That doesn't mean that you couldn't go to university or whatever, but it will be an enormous help, right? It would change your mind if you'd be exposed to trade, right? Because we don't make things anymore, huh? When we look around, if a new building's gone up, it's a warehouse. We import more and more, and we export less and less. So hopefully that will be a great where a lot of young people, where, you know, when you be 20 or in your early 20s, you don't know yourself quite that well. Experiment a bit. Do something what you enjoy. When you enjoy something, you're going to be good in it. If you put in the extra effort, you could be one of the best, whatever you're involved. When you be one of the best, money is a byproduct. But the one thing you should never forget, you're fortunate that you grew up reasonably healthy, that you have parents which gave you a chance that you could attend universities. So after you finished your thing and you make some monies, never forget, you know, you gotta give back something to society. That's a very important. But you gotta write. Let entrepreneurs, let them make 50 million, 100 or 500. It's only the very large, where it's the billions, where you got to share, because those companies are not run anymore by owners or by entrepreneurs, usually institutions. They got no affinity for people, for employees. So we need a thing here. And again, I created a role model. If you share with the employees, you get so much back. I hope I've provoked your mind a bit. I hope when you leave here, they say, gee, I didn't waste my Saturday afternoon. I hope that, and I would be very happy to answer questions. Only by asking questions can you enrich your mind. And okay, so
I'm very happy to answer your question now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Stronach, for that inspiring talk that was so filled with so much information. And I think I can speak for everybody here in saying that there were so many insights on the importance of developing an economic charter of rights in order to ensure economic sustainability, innovative governance, and ultimately, really, to benefit conditions for all Canadians. So thank you again. That was incredible. One thing that I also truly admire about Mr. Stronach, and for those of you who follow his columns and have read some of Mr. Stronach's work and seen some of his other talks, is it's also followed by, first of all, genuine action in a lot of the things that Mr. Stronach is doing. But in addition to that, specific calls to action and very specific strategies that we can do as universities in terms of knowledge creation, but also that our government can do and actions that we can take. And so I think that's remarkable. I'm Professor Julie McCarthy in the Department of Management, and I have the great honor now of facilitating the Q&A.
It's more if we look at China, a country like China, where you have dozens of car companies in the EV space, and then you look at Canada, and we don't have any companies in the EV space doing the manufacturing sales. I'm just wondering if you have an opinion on why that's the case, and that we see a lot of innovation, manufacturing for leading edge, next generation cars, but in Canada, we don't tend to see that similar pattern.
Could you repeat the question?
So the question is about why in Canada do we not see as much
manufacturing
of electronic vehicles? But in other countries, we see that this is, happening much more quickly. And it's so why in Canada are we not seeing this?
It's quite simple. But 50 years ago, when the first computers came on the market, the slogan was, if you got one of those, you could eliminate a total office floor. Now, when I look around in the Western countries, Canada, States, or Europe, you got 20 times more office buildings in the cities. What do you think they're doing there? It's regulations. We got away from the real economy to a financial economy. So 50 years ago, besides the computers, Wall Street was pushing business. You got to make more profits on the one hand. The unions were pushing, workers got to make more money, so business took the easy way out. They went to China or to Asia, right? Okay, and thereby we start to make less and less and less. So I'm appealing, we have to. That's why it's so important, right? That if you pursue, your career, etc. If you have some experience, if you try some trades, it will give you so much more knowledge for whatever you want to do. Huh? And you might decide you want to be in XXX and make things, mm-hmm. because in the final analysis, when you make products, right, a million of this, a million of that, you can make more monies, okay? So, but you need the understanding for products. So I think the trade from grade 11 and grade 12 is absolutely crucial. And so it gives you a chance to see the economy from a different side. And you can go to university, you still could be a lawyer, you still could be a financial expert, but my advice to you, get involved and do it. It will change your mind.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm getting tons of questions pouring in here, so this is wonderful. I'll take one from the audience and then we'll move to some people who are lined up here. So one of the questions I have here, this is a big one. How did you choose to get into the automotive industry? Why that field?
Well, I've said life is the question of fate and circumstances. It just happened that way, right? When I came, there was a big recession. My first job was in a hospital. I felt so sorry for myself. I was in the kitchen peeling potatoes, salads, and worked together with a lot of elderly women. Nothing against elderly women. My mother was an elderly woman, and I loved her, right? But I felt sorry. I thought I will do some manly things, to cut wood down or trees down or stone, whatever. So I did wind up in a small company, right?
Right.
And they did some automotive, and so I just got in the automotive. It was, again, a pure chance, pure luck.
Interesting. Okay, great. Thank you so much. Let's go to this speaker over here, please.
Mr. Stronach, thank you for speaking to us today. It's a very, very interesting talk. I'm really interested in the fact that you have a very humane approach, which is also extremely successful. You talked about productivity increasing dramatically as a consequence of your sharing, your profit sharing with workers, in addition to the other people who contributed to your business. I'm wondering, how receptive have you found other businesses to that approach? Because it seems to me that in consideration of how effective it's been, that other businesses would want to follow that. And that doesn't seem to have been the case across the board. What do you think can be done to improve the number of businesses that take that approach, that humane profit-sharing approach with your employees?
So the question is, the profit-sharing approach that you've used at Magna has been so successful. And so have other businesses taken on that approach? Have you found that they've been open to that approach? Why don't more businesses in Canada engage in the profit-sharing that Magna did?
Again, it's I worked for that small company. There were about 10 people, and the owner said, "Gee, Frank, you're doing a great job," and my chest swelled a little. He was a nice guy, but he never wrote it. He always said, "Look, I want you to be a partner of mine," but he never wrote it down. Huh? So my thing was, gee, there's nothing to it to run the thing. I left there. I went to a place where I could make more monies. I rented a small room. The washroom was down the hallway. I saved all the money. And in 57, I had about $5,000 saved up. That would be now maybe around $100,000. I bought a few used machines. I rented the gatehouse of Standard American on Dufferin DuPont. And out I went hustling. I went in the factory and I said, I'm great in solving problems. And I said, look, if I can't solve the problems, you don't have to pay me. After 1 month, I'd hired somebody. After a year, about 10 people. After 2 years, 20. After 5 years, about 5,000. After 10 years, about 50,000. After 20 years, 100,000. Then 150. So it is really, but the reason I was able to do that was, when I go back to the small company, right, when I had 20 people, I noticed my foreman was a little different. His name was Herman. I said, "What's the matter with you, Herman, lately?" "Well," he said, "Frank, I'm thinking of starting my own factory." So I said, "Well, I have an understanding." So I said, "Look, let's talk tomorrow about it, and maybe we could come up with a good solution." That evening, I was talking to myself, which said, "If that foreman's going to leave me..." Somebody sneezing. So if that foreman's going to leave me, that would stifle my growth. I didn't like that. The next thing, if that foreman's going to leave me, I have to do all the work myself. So the third reason was, if I hire a new foreman and I don't show him how a business is, I still have to do all the work. I said to him, "Look, why don't we open up a factory together? You own a third, and I own two-thirds. No more overtime. By the end of the year, we take some monies out. We leave some monies in for expansions." He said, "You mean it?" I said, "Yes." We went to a lawyer right away, wrote it down. The guy worked like crazy. That was his factory. I took the next foreman, the next foreman, the next foreman. All of a sudden, I was a young guy, still had a lot of factories, right? And the next thing was then I said to myself, I gotta get the employees involved too, right? And I came to the conclusion I should be a public company, and your shares, you can't trade in, whatever. And I came to the conclusion that all workers have a right. I wanted to motivate them and say, gee, I make a contribution, right? They on the front line, they can see things. It's an enormous energy you release, right? And I hopefully, you know, that we get that across. So it's absolutely necessary. Society cannot. People don't want to be servants, huh? Okay, look, at Magnet, there's no bosses, right? It's a set luck. Some have more responsibility than others, and that's the way it goes. Mm-hmm. And we in society, we realize somebody's got to clean the sewers, but the covers shouldn't be screwed tight on. You should be able to climb out of the sewers and perhaps hold the highest office in the country. Okay, that's the kind of country we want, that everybody's got an equal chance. Yes, we know if we don't hustle and don't drive, we make it a little less. If we hustle and drive, we can do better, right? So we need examples, right? Kids want to have a thing. I want to be as good as the hockey player XXX, a football player in business too. I want to be able to do great things like that entrepreneur, mm-hmm. which made a 50 million in a few years. That's the kind of society we want. But we gotta lay down what are the minimum standards of a civilized society. In a civilized society, nobody should go too hungry to bed, and everybody should have shelter. And food and medical attention.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much. I have so many questions coming in on my phone, so this is amazing. We only have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to allow. I know you've been waiting. If you could please go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, Mr. Shonak. I just wanted to say it was an amazing lecture.
Bit louder. Can you just speak a little louder? Yeah, thank you.
My fault. I just had a question. So I liked a couple points that you said based on how kids shouldn't be going hungry to school and stuff like that. But one thing that you said that stuck with me was how you feel like in 20 years we would be able to eliminate debt. So I was wondering what you meant by that, and if you could like be a little bit more specific, as if you meant we could eliminate all debt, or what were we supposed to do to make that work?
So the question is about eliminating debt. So in your talk, you mentioned that in 20 years, we hopefully will eliminate all debt in Canada so that we can be, which would be incredible. The question is about how will we get there, and what exactly did you mean? Like, what kind of debt were you talking about?
Well, if you don't have a budget, right? The budget we way over, right?
Right.
Okay, so the debt's climbing. It's, I don't know how many trillions, right?
Crazy.
But it's enormous, mm-hmm. right? So every housewife knows she cannot spend more monies than what the husband brings home. Otherwise, they wind up in a poorhouse. Every farmer knows he cannot spend more what he would get for his crop. Otherwise, he loses the farm. Our politicians don't know, right? Okay, how dreadful that is, mm-hmm. because I've never seen the other bank will say, we'll forgive you the debt.
Yeah.
So it's by if the workers can participate, we can pay it back pretty quick, because there would be productivity. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. We can easily do that if workers would get a portion of the profits in a tangible way, and we could the debt could be paid back
right.
very quick. If we leave it the way it is, there's no future.
No,
there's no future if if but not even for you, because you many of you in your early 20s, and if you have kids, there's just no future with this amount of debt which is accumulated.
Mm-hmm. Which gets right back to the economic charter of rights that Mr. Stronach has been talking about and writes about quite a bit, a lot, and writes about these exact issues. So, yeah, you might find that really interesting as well. Thank you. We have 3 minutes left, so I think we have time for one last quick question. So, please.
Firstly, thank you so much for your time, sir. My question for you today is, what one piece of advice would you give to your 18-year-old self?
What piece of advice would you give to your 18-year-old self?
Well, if I have a son, learn a trade or a number of trades and see what you like. If you don't like it, search for another trade and make something and do something rather than be in an office and juggle around with numbers. I want to stress too, my day, every day, I have to think about it. What do I have to do that workers respect me? Okay, that is, you know, that the respect is there. And we had a unique system. We audited the human capital, huh?
Right.
As you know, you have audits and you got for tax reason, for any other reason. You audit the financial capital, but we audit the human capital for the simple reason: if you don't do things right, if you discriminate, or you know, all those things make employees unhappy. Unhappiness is contagious. When you get unhappy employees, there's no way you can make a quality product at a competitive price. So it's absolutely necessary to flush out if something isn't done right, huh? Okay? Because when I had a small company, I know everybody, but when you get larger, right? We had a special team which audited human capital. Let's say they went in the morning and thing, every employee got an envelope with a questionnaire in there, and they could write out, they didn't have to put the name on it, and we could immediately, you know, the next day, we could immediately tell whether the workers happy in that factory or not. So it is, it's an ongoing question to be fair, to not to discriminate, and interface with employees. If they are happy, it's an amazing thing what they can do.